Hello and welcome to The Wire, your national and independent coverage of current affairs right across Australia on community and Indigenous radio. I'm Emma Watsky, coming to you from Radio Adelaide here in Tandunya, on the lands of Kanamina. Our team pays our deepest respect to elders past, present and emerging. We extend this respect to all First Nations listeners and to the rightful custodians of the lands you're listening in from. And today on the show...
But my pathway into politics was after I lost my leg. I was just really frustrated with so much of the world outside me. And I thought the only way to make change is to be involved in policy and policy development.
Former LNP opposition leader Peter Dutton lost his seat of Dixon against Labor's Ali France, an advocate of the NDIS. We hear more on her journey as an Australian with a disability and why she moved into politics. Also, controversial anti-immigration rallies are set to take place in all major cities this weekend. And later...
We really just want to emphasise that it's an opportunity for communities to hold events, to encourage building awareness of overdose prevention, remembering loved ones, and generally taking action to prevent this very unnecessary tragedy.
1,878 unintentional drug-induced deaths occurred in 2022. Far exceeding the road toll for that year. This Sunday shines a light on the devastating reality and need for ongoing action. We'll have this and more for you over the next half hour. We're on air across Australia, thanks to the Community Radio Network and the support from the Community Broadcasting Foundation. First up, the federal government has introduced Home Affairs legislation proposing to strip back protections for immigrants and those seeking refugee status. The proposed legislation would allow the government to more easily detain and deport those who cannot adhere to certain instruction. Pushback from human rights organisations has resulted in a joint statement calling for the proposed bill to be overturned and blocked. The Wire's Zachary Probert spoke with Associate Legal Director at the Human Rights Law Centre, Laura John, to discuss the bill further.
Last year, in the final sitting week of Parliament, the Albanese government rushed through laws to exile people to third countries and force them to comply with removal directions or face jail. And what the government has done this week is to introduce new laws that dangerously expand these powers. There are three main aspects of this new law, this anti-fairness bill. The first removes the government's duty to give a person a fair chance to explain why they shouldn't be deported. Now, what this means is that the government wouldn't have to consider basic questions about whether a person could access medical care in the third country, whether they would face harm in the third country, or even whether they would be permanently separated from their family. Now, the bill also removes the government's duty to give a person a fair chance to explain why they couldn't comply with a removal direction. So to give you an example, the government could give a mother a direction requiring her to obtain a passport for her child, and she would have no opportunity to explain that she simply couldn't get the father's consent due to family violence and so couldn't get that passport for her child. But her failure to comply with that direction could result in jail time. So by eliminating these safeguards that are designed to ensure fairness and which are fundamental to our legal system, the government is trying to legislate its own willful ignorance. And it's showing that it really doesn't care if it gets these life-changing decisions wrong.
So you're saying they've completely scrapped any form of legal protections at all. Is there anything that can help defend people looking for immigration or refugee situations?
So what these laws are trying to do is to create essentially a parallel system that subjects migrants and refugees to harsher treatment purely on the basis of their visa status. So what these laws are aimed at is removing natural justice principles that are there to ensure fairness. So it really means that this group of migrants and refugees are facing a parallel system where they won't be able to access really basic rights to be able to be heard and to be able to explain their situation before really significant decisions are taken, such as the decision to deport them.
Are people within these situations able to defend themselves, or is it completely up to the government's decision within a case-to-case basis?
When it comes to deportation, what it would essentially mean is that a person who is facing deportation would have to be able to access lawyers very quickly in order for potentially court action to be taken. It's really not good enough for a person to have to depend on being able to access legal assistance when they're already in a deeply vulnerable position, probably in immigration detention, in order to vindicate their rights. And in the other situation where the department might issue a person with a direction to cooperate with their removal, the only option a person would have would be to explain why they weren't able to comply in the course of criminal charges. It's really not fair for that onus to be on people in those situations to, after the fact, have to explain what has occurred. And when it comes to deportation, it's simply might be too late at that point for any of these arguments to be made.
What accountability will there be for the government and its relevant departments if this bill is passed?
Well, we would strongly encourage all members of parliament to think very carefully about the implications of this bill, and we don't think that it should become law. We think the bill should be rejected in its entirety. If it does become law, it's another example of the Albanese government removing the very few accountability mechanisms that still exist for migrants and refugees. And that would be a very terrible thing, not just for the people who are directly impacted, but also for all Australians and for our community, because this then becomes the standard that we accept for people who have come here seeking protection. The other aspect of the bill that we haven't touched on yet is a really blatant attempt by the Albanese government to circumvent the court, because there are cases that have been made, that court decisions that have been made, that essentially say that certain visa decisions were made incorrectly because they were based on wrong information and outdated law. And now what this new bill attempts to do is to retrospectively validate all of those visa decisions that were made incorrectly. So it's just another example of the Albanese government trying to circumvent court decisions, preempt court decisions that it doesn't like, and again would result in migrants and refugees being subjected to this parallel legal system just because of their visa status.
Associate Legal Director at the Human Rights Law Centre, Laura John, speaking with The Wire's Zachary Probert. The Wire has reached out to the Department of Home Affairs for further comment. The statement is available at www.thewire.org.au.
Have you checked out The Wire? It's your national current affairs program. The Wire, taking an independent look at what's happening in Australia and around the world. Fresh voices, new points of view, current affairs with a difference. Don't miss The Wire, daily on community and Indigenous radio across Australia.
That's how many unintentional drug-induced deaths occurred in 2022, far exceeding the road toll for that year, according to the Pennington Institute's 2024 annual overdose report. Research from the University of New South Wales also highlights a concerning upward trend in overdose-related deaths, with statistics seeing an average increase of 4.2% per year between 2004 and 2023, an issue impacting people from all walks of life and their loved ones. This Sunday hosts the world's largest annual campaign to end overdose, and it's convened by the Pennington Institute, an independent drug policy non-for-profit organisation intended to put vital conversation in the spotlight. Nikki Page spoke with Director of Research, Dr. Jake Gizzard, to hear more.
I'm from a part of the United States, Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania, that has been an epicenter of the United States overdose crisis for a very long time. I know many people and families that have been directly affected by overdose, so I've always been interested in actions that can be taken both by communities and governments to limit the number of overdoses and stop the pain that overdose causes for people and communities.
A question which is relating to the pain that overdose causes people, would you agree that one of the issues is that people don't think it's important enough because they think it doesn't affect them?
I think that there certainly is a stigma and a discrimination attached to drug use in general, certainly in part because it is illegal and in part because people associate it with elements of society that they disassociate themselves from in some ways. First of all, that's just not true. Overdose affects people from all walks of life. It is a common thing across different types of communities and different social strata all across Australia. It is also not just about illicit substances. Most overdose deaths involve a variety of substances, what we call polydrug use,
And in many times, that includes prescription drugs, for instance. So antidepressants, antipsychotics, benzodiazepines, these are all types of drugs that are frequently implicated in overdose. So it is simply the sort of stereotype that a lot of people have in their head that it's just somebody who may have refused help and maybe is taking methamphetamine or heroin is just very often not true.
The statistics are shocking, really, aren't they? Almost twice the number of road traffic deaths every year in Australia, just speaking about Australia. Who is being hit hardest?
So one of the first things to note is that since the time period that we have good data for, which is basically the beginning of this century, the rate of overdose deaths has increased across the country and increased in nearly every state and territory. I'm glad to say it is down a little bit. A peak in the late 2010s, around 2018, but it is still significantly higher than it was in 2001. In terms of drug types, it's hard to say that the burden is falling hardest on anyone in particular. Certainly, opioids, which includes not just heroin, but all sorts of pharmaceutical opioids and some other illicit drugs as well, have been consistently the drug most commonly involved in overdose. But aside from opioids, they're really, it runs the gamut of drug types. I mentioned some of the other pharmaceutical types before. Also, stimulants, including methamphetamine, that's the second most commonly involved drug type. But really, it's something that crosses boundaries.
Do we have any idea of the impact of safe injecting rooms?
It's hard to say because there are a lot of things that affect the number of overdoses in any given year. It's a little bit hard to detect the effect of those from a society-wide public health level. But we know simply from the numbers that are produced by the overdose prevention sites in Melbourne and Sydney, people routinely show up and require care from the nursing and medical staff at those sites, and they have reversed hundreds of overdoses over the lifespan of those two services. I'm glad you mentioned those sites because it actually draws our attention to one of the most important policy initiatives the community can engage in to limit overdose deaths, which is wider distribution of naloxone, which is a really effective reversal drug for opioid overdoses. Completely safe, can be any member of the public can be easily trained to administer it safely. It won't cause negative adverse effects if the person is not suffering from an opioid overdose. And the federal government has, and state governments as well, have made some important progress in getting wider distribution of naloxone, but we still want to see it distributed much more widely, including being carried by all first responders, including police. We're making progress on getting it into more first aid kits and having naloxone administration be part of first aid training, but it's still not standard part of all first aid kits, including in nightlife venues and entertainment venues where overdose might occur. So we still want to see wider distribution. I just want to highlight International Overdose Awareness Day is this coming Sunday, August 31st. We really just want to emphasize that it's an opportunity for communities to hold events, to encourage building awareness of overdose prevention, remembering loved ones, and generally taking action to prevent this very unnecessary tragedy.
Director of Research at the Pennington Institute, Dr. Jake Gizzard, speaking with The Wire's Nikki Page. Controversial March for Australia has sparked an outpouring of concern, with rallies planned across major cities this weekend, calling for an end to mass migration and retrieval of Australia's identity. Members of immigrant and multicultural communities fear they could become targeted. Rallies have been condemned by a number of left-wing groups, with the events reportedly linked with a white nationalist ideology, and the March for Australia website clearly stating no foreign flags. Dr. Cass Ross, independent researcher into extremism and far-right conspiracy theories, says the march is highly divisive.
This particular march is very, very divisive. And that's because the aim of this march, while it's called March for Australia, is an anti-migration march. The organisers have said that it's anti-mass migration, so they've tried to present a nuanced view that there's a difference between orderly migration and what we have now, mass migration. They portray that as just the indiscriminate letting in of anybody in the world into Australia. Obviously, that's inaccurate. We do have an orderly migration process, but they've called it a rally against mass migration, by which they actually mean against all migration. So the people behind the rally are basically calling for all migration in Australia to be stopped. They want to go a step further, and they've called for re-migration. So this was something that appeared on their website, which they've since taken down once people noticed it. But remigration is the idea that even if you were born here or your parents were born here, if you're not white, you need to leave the country and be deported. And it's an idea that comes from the neo-Nazi far-right movement in Europe. Not everybody going to the march actually understands what those ideas are.
How divisive is that component, calling on people that effectively don't know what they're signing up for?
It's very divisive because it's actually a bit of a bait and switch with the people who think they're going there to make a protest to the government about cost of living or housing or we need to buy Australian or something like that. But they're going there to be used for propaganda purposes. They've called no foreign flags at this rally and they've included the Aboriginal flag in that.
You have touched on this, but the organisation's website states, for years, Australia's unity and shared values have been eroded by policies and movements that divide us. The march has been listed as an attempt to protect white heritage. Is this a front?
Yeah, definitely. One of the organisers, who's the national coordinator and the organiser of the Sydney March, has said very clearly, we need to get people understanding they need to protect Australian culture, and by that we mean European culture, and by that we mean white culture. This is where the organisers of the march are basically replicating neo-Nazi talking points about white Australians being replaced in their own country, and that white Australians need to unite.
Before protests have even hit the street, a great deal of traction has been gained online. How significant is the online environment and that sense of preliminary fear around this kind of messaging?
This is absolutely central. This is something that has been organised online. It's been billed by the organisers as a grassroots movement, but it's something that's whipped up online. It's attracted quite a lot of attention.
Attention indeed continues as Sunday looms closer. Media coverage has increased, as have responses through online platforms. Victorian socialists and left-wing groups have taken to social media, urging an anti-fascist mobilisation. Strategic Executive Leader and former CEO of Multicultural Australia, Christine Carsley, wrote online, stating migration is one of Australia's greatest success stories. She points to data that migration grows our economy, fills skill gaps, and enriches our culture. While a number of ethnic groups have been reported saying they remain concerned about going outside during the protests, Dr. Ross believes the rallies shouldn't be a reason to stay in.
My own personal opinion is that these rallies will be largely peaceful. I believe the organisers when they say that they're aiming to have peaceful rallies. So I think that people can go about their everyday lives and not be at all worried. They don't have to stay at home scared in their homes if they're not white. Unfortunately, all of this has just whipped it up into quite a bit of a frenzy, and the organisers are expecting really big numbers in the cities on these days. I'd also point out that this rally was called deliberately and provocatively at 12 noon on a Sunday, which is the day that the big pro-Palestine rallies gather in the capital cities. Mm. And I believe that this was a deliberate provocation to try to engineer conflict, but I believe that police will be on top of it and will hold the two sides apart on the day. I believe that there are adequate police laws in place that can be used by the police. I think we need to be pointing out the fact that neo-Nazis marching on the street is not a good idea. We need to be calling that out and developing some sort of social response.
Dr. Cass Ross speaking with me.
Across Australia, you're listening to The Wire, Community Radio's National Current Affairs program.
The last federal election saw now former LNP opposition leader Peter Dutton lose the seat of Dixon against Labor's Ali France. In 2011, Miss France was seriously injured and lost her leg, which saw her family navigate through the NDIS. She has since become an advocate towards the scheme. Powered Media's reporter Emma Myers spoke with Ali France about how important the NDIS is, her journey as an Australian with a disability, and how she got involved in politics.
I was very naive to the obstacles that people with a disability are faced with every day out in the community until I myself had those obstacles. I lost my leg in 2011. I was a pedestrian and a car ran into me and my son. I spent the first 2.5 years in my chair, and I still spend a lot of time in my chair, but also as an above-knee amputee, I also walk around a little bit. But my pathway into politics was after I lost my leg. I was just really frustrated with so much of the world outside me, and I thought the only way to make change is to be involved in policy and policy development, and that's how I made my way. I joined the Labor Party and started getting involved.
What challenges did you initially face after your accident?
Firstly, it was recovering from the trauma. It took at least 6 months just for my leg to heal, and I was having nursing at home during that period. I had terrible chronic PTSD and very bad anxiety. I really struggled to get out of the house for 2 or 3 years. I wasn't able to use a traditional socket because I had a crush injury, so that was really devastating. No matter how hard I tried, I couldn't use the traditional socket. So then I ended up having this groundbreaking surgery for osseointegration, which has given me the opportunity to walk and stand a bit more. But the other obstacles were just getting around to the community, like getting a disabled parking space at the shops, or so that I can go to the post office or I can go to the chemist. I found that a lot of places that I used to go had stairs. It was just incredibly difficult navigating the world outside me. It still is.
And have you found that there are some barriers that are, shall we say, specific to women with disability?
Yes, I definitely think that there are specific issues for women, particularly in getting back into the workforce. I think that the usual bias that happens for women and men and getting pay parity and getting jobs, you just add to that disability. And as a disabled woman, we know from the statistics, you're less likely than a disabled man to get a job. And that means you're less likely to prosper. It's all compounded. And I think that there are definitely specific issues for women who have experienced domestic violence. It's very difficult as a woman with a disability whose carer is the one perpetrating the violence.
You talk a lot about the cost of childcare. How did the cost of childcare affect your family?
I wasn't a single mother when my kids were going through childcare. But back then, almost 20 years ago, I had to stop work. We lost money as a family, about $300 a week if I stayed at work and sent my kids to childcare. So yeah, it was a really big issue. It's a huge barrier for women trying to get back to work. But also, I'm pleased that for disabled women, we've scrapped the activity test for our childcare reforms, which means that you don't have to prove that you're working for your kids to be able to access free childcare. I think that many children of single mothers with a disability should be able to have the same opportunities to go to childcare as families that don't have a disability and who are working. So that was an important change that the Albanese Labor government introduced.
You talk about parents with a disability. What kind of feedback have you heard from parents with a disability?
Yeah, well, I've had mums who haven't been able to get a job, whose kids were not able to access the childcare opportunities that other kids were able to access at the age of 3 or 4. And I think scrapping the activity test was a huge difference for that, because all kids should have the opportunity to learn and get the best start in life. I think the NDIS is key to women with significant disability being able to enjoy their motherhood and be able to care for their kids. And they should be able to do that just as much as women without a disability. Everything that you're doing as a parent, cooking, cleaning, bathing, getting them to their sporting activities, getting them to school and back, all of that just becomes a bit harder if you're a woman with a disability. And that's why the NDIS is so important, to provide support so you can be the mum that you want to be.
Member for Dixon, Ali France, speaking with Powered Media's Emma Myers. And for the full interview, you can go to their website on powerd.media. And unfortunately, that's the end of the show today. Thanks so much for being with me. I'm Emma Watsky from Radio Adelaide here in Tandanya. Stay tuned for Monday's show brought to you from Brisbane. The Wire is a weekday co-production between 2SER in Gadigal, Sydney, 4ZZZ and Radio 4EB in Meanjin, Brisbane and Melbourne, and Radio Adelaide, with the great support of the Community Broadcasting Foundation and the Community Radio Network. You can hop online to check out our stories at thewire.org.au and follow us on Facebook, X and LinkedIn. Thanks so much for your company, and we'll see you next week on The Wire. We'll be right back.